So today, to sort of switch things up, I thought I would, instead of giving a talk from something from my own brain, I thought I'd read something which might be of use to meditators or Buddhists or people on the path. So what follows is an excerpt from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the discourse on the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma, which is a series of talks given by a very famous teacher from Burma. And it's based on a discourse that the Buddha gave called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. So this is a discourse on the discourse, a talk on the talk which the Buddha gave, a sort of an explanation of the Buddha's talk. So he starts by quoting the Buddha in Pali. Dve me bhikkave anta bapajite nana sevitabha. Bhikkhus, one who has gone forth from the worldly life, should not indulge in these two extreme parts, which will be presently explained. And why shouldn't he indulge in these? Because the main purpose of one who has gone forth from the worldly life is to rid himself of such defilements as lust and anger. This objective cannot be achieved by indulging in the two extreme things, for they will only tend to promote further accumulation of lust and anger. What are the two extreme things? Delighting in desirable sense objects, pursuing and enjoying sensuous pleasure, constitute one extreme practice. This practice is low, vulgar, being the habit of village and town folks, indulged in by ordinary common worldlings, not pursued by the noble ones, ignoble, unclean, not tending to the true interests one is seeking after. Such pursuit after sensuous pleasures is an extreme practice which should be avoided. There are five kinds of desirable sense objects, namely pleasurable sight, pleasurable sounds, pleasurable smells, tastes, and touch. In brief, all the material objects, animate or inanimate, enjoyed by people in the world. Delighting in a seemingly pleasurable sight and enjoying it constitute practice and pursuit of sensuality. Here, the sense object of sight means not merely a source of light or color that comes into contact with the seeing eye, but the man or woman or the whole of the object that forms the source or origin of that sight. Similarly, all sources of sound, smell, and touch, whether man, woman, or instrumental objects, constitute sensuous objects. As regards taste, not only the various foods, fruits, and delicacies, but also men, women, and people who prepare and serve them, are classified as objects of taste. Listening to a pleasant sound, smelling a sweet, fragrant smell, are as sensuous as enjoyment of good, delicious food, luxury of a comfortable bed, or physical contact with the opposite sex. Delighting in sensuous pleasures and relishing them is to be regarded as a vulgar practice because such enjoyments lead to formation of base desires, which are clinging and lustful. They tend to promote self-conceit with the thought that no one else is in the same position to enjoy such pleasures. At the same time, one becomes oppressed with thoughts of avarice, not wishing to share the good fortune with others, or overcome by thoughts of jealousy, envy, anxious to deny similar pleasures to others. It arouses ill will towards those who are thought to be opposed to oneself. Flushed with success and affluence, one becomes shameless and unscrupulous, bold and reckless in one's behavior, no longer afraid to do evils. One begins to deceive oneself with false impression of well-being and prosperity. The newly informed worldling may also come to hold the wrong view of living soul or atta or self, to entertain disbelief in the resultant effects of one's own actions, karma. Such being the outcome of delighting in and relishing of sensual pleasures, they are to be regarded as low and base. Furthermore, indulgence in sensual pleasures is the habitual practice of lower forms of creatures, such as animals, ghosts, and so on. The monks and novices belonging to the higher stages of existence should not stoop low to view with the lower forms of life in the vulgar practice of base sensuality. Pursuit after sensuous pleasures does not lie within the province of one who has gone forth from the worldly life. It is the concern of the town and village folks who regard sensual pleasures as the highest attributes of bliss. The greater the pleasures, the greater the happiness. In ancient times, rulers and rich people engaged themselves in the pursuit of sensual pleasures. Wars were waged and violent conquests made, all for the gratification of sense desire. In modern times, too, similar conquests are still being made, in some areas for the same objectives. But it is not only the rulers and the rich who seek sensual pleasures. The poor are also arduous in the pursuit of worldly goods and pleasures. As a matter of fact, as soon as adolescence is reached, the instinct for mating and sexual gratification makes itself felt. For the worldly householder veiled from the Buddha and the Dhamma, gratification of sense desires appears to be indeed the acme of happiness and bliss. Even before the time of the Buddha, there were people who held the belief that heavenly bliss could be enjoyed in this very life. According to them, sensual pleasures was indeed blissful. There was nothing to surpass it, and that pleasure was to be enjoyed in this very life. It would be foolish to let precious moments for enjoyment pass, waiting for the bliss in future life, which does not exist. The time for full gratification of sensual pleasures is now, this very life. Such is the heavenly bliss which they believe in this very life. This is one of the 62 wrong views expounded by the Buddha in the Brahmajala Sutta of the Sila Kanda of the Digha Nikaya. Thus, enjoyment of sensual pleasures is the preoccupation of town and village people, not the concern of recluses and monks. For them, to go after sense desire would mean reverting back to the worldly life which they have renounced. People show great reverence to them, believing they are leading a holy life undisturbed by worldly distraction or allurement of the opposite sex. People making the best offer of food and clothing to the recluses, denying these to themselves, often at the sacrifice of the needs of their dear ones and their family. It would be most improper for the monks to seek worldly pleasures, just like the householders, while living on the charity of the people. In addition, monks renounce the world with a vow to work for the release from the sufferings inherent in the rounds of rebirth and for the realization of Nibbana. It is obvious that these noble ideals cannot be attained by the monks if they go after sensual pleasures in the manner of householders. Thus, one who has gone forth from the worldly life should not indulge in delightful sensuous pleasures. The majority of people in the world are ordinary, common folk engaged in seeking the means of living and enjoying sensual pleasures. There are only a few who can rise above the common crowd, who can see the Dharma and live a holy life. It is not for them to indulge in coarse worldly pleasures, which is the main concern of the lower class of beings. Enjoyment of worldly pleasures is not the practice of the noble ones. One may ask here why the noble ones like Visakha, Anattapindika, and the Sakha, the king of the angels, who had already reached the first stage of the noble life, engaged themselves in pursuit of sensuous pleasures. In Sotapannas, or stream enterers, lust and passions are not yet overcome. There still lingers in them the incipient perception of agreeableness of carnal pleasures. This point is illustrated in the Anguttara Nikaya by the example of a person who is fastidious in the habits of cleanliness, but seeks shelter in a filthy place filled with excrement to avoid attack by an elephant in must. This defiling coarse habit, being ignoble and unclean, should be avoided by recluses and monks. This practice does not tend to one's own welfare or well-being. In the common popular view, making money and accumulating wealth, establishing a family life with retinues and a circle of friends, in short, striving for success and prosperity in this world, appears indeed to be working for one's own welfare. Actually, however, such worldly success and prosperity do not amount to one's own well-being. One's true interest lies in seeking ways of overcoming old age, disease, and death, and attaining release from all forms of suffering. The only way to escape from all forms of suffering is through development of morality, concentration, and insight wisdom. Only these, namely morality, concentration, and wisdom, are to be sought for in the true interest of oneself. Pursuit of sensual pleasures cannot lead to the conquest of old age, disease, death, or all forms of suffering. It only tends to breach the code of morality, such as the commitment of illegal sexual conduct. Seeking worldly amenities through killing, theft, or deceit also amounts to violation of moral precepts, not to speak of physical actions, mere thought of enjoyment of sensual pleasures prohibits development of mental concentration and wisdom, and thus forms a hindrance to the realization of Nibbana, the cessation of suffering. Failure to observe moral precepts is a sure step to the four nether worlds of intense suffering. It is to be noted, however, that maintenance of moral character alone, without simultaneous development of samadhi, of wisdom, concentration and wisdom, will not lead to enlightenment. It only encourages rebirth repeatedly in happier existences, where, however, manifold sufferings such as old age, disease, and death are still encountered again and again. Recluses and monks, having renounced the world, with the avowed purpose of achieving enlightenment, where all sufferings cease, should have nothing to do with the pursuit of sensuous pleasures that only obstruct development of morality, concentration, and wisdom. To recapitulate, enjoyment of sensual pleasures is low, vulgar, being the preoccupation of common people of low intelligence, unclean, ignoble, not practiced by the noble ones. It is detrimental to the progress in morality, concentration, and wisdom, and thus works against the true interest of those intent on achievement of the unaged, undeceased, the deathless, the Nibbana. The text only says that one who has gone forth from the worldly life should not indulge in sensuous pleasures. The question, therefore, arises whether ordinary householders who remain amidst the worldly surroundings should freely pursue sensuous pleasures without any restraint. Since the gratification of sense desires is the preoccupation of common people, it would be pointless to enjoy them from doing so. But the householder intent on practicing the noble Dhamma should advisedly avoid these pleasures to the extent necessary for practice. Observance of the five precepts requires abstaining from commitment of sins of the flesh. Likewise, possession of worldly goods should not be sought through killing, theft, or deceit. In the Pasadika Sutta of the Patthikavagadika Nikaya, Buddha had stated four kinds of indulgence in worldly enjoyments. Sunda, in this world there are some foolish, ignorant people who promote their own enrichment by the slaughter of animals, cattle, pigs, chicken, fish. This practice constitutes the first form of indulgence in worldly enjoyments. Theft and robbery consist of the second form of indulgence in worldly enjoyments, while deceitful means of earning one's livelihood constitute the third. The fourth form of indulgence embraces other means besides these three by which worldly wealth is gained. The sutta stated that Buddha's disciples, monks, were free from these indulgences. Lay people, in observing the eight precepts and ten precepts, have to maintain chastity and abstain from partaking of food after midday, dancing and singing, all of these being forms of sensuous pleasure. When one is engaged in meditation practices, one has to forego all kinds of sensuous enjoyments, just like the monks who have gone forth from the worldly life, because they tend to hinder the development of morality, concentration, and wisdom. A meditator, even if he is a lay person, must not, therefore, indulge in worldly enjoyments. This should suffice regarding one form of extreme practice, namely indulgence in worldly enjoyments. The second extreme, practice of self-mortification, results only in self's torture and suffering. It is not the practice of the noble ones, hence ignoble, unclean, and does not tend to one's own practical welfare and interest. This extreme practice should also be avoided. Self-mortification, which leads only to suffering, was practiced by those who held the belief that luxurious living would cause attachment to sensuous pleasures, and that only austerity practices, denying oneself sense objects such as food and clothing, would remove sense desires. Then only the eternal peace, the state of the unaged, undiseased, the deathless, could be achieved. Such was the belief of those who practiced self-mortification. Good monks cover themselves with robes and clothing for decency and to shield themselves from heat and cold, from insects, flies, and mosquitoes. But self-mortifiers go about without any clothing. When the weather is cold, they immerse themselves under water. When hot, they expose themselves to the sun, standing amidst four fireplaces, thus subjecting themselves to heat from five directions. This is known as the fivefold penance by heat. They have no use for regular beds, lying on the naked ground for resting. Some of them resort to lying on prickly thorns, covered only by a sheet of clothing. There are some who remain in a sitting posture for days, while others keep to standing only, neither lying nor sitting down. One form of self-infliction is to lie hanging down, suspended from a tree branch by two legs. To stand straight on one's head in a topsy-turvy posture is yet another. Whereas it is the normal habit of good monks to assuage hunger by partaking of food, some self-tormentors completely cut off food and water. There are some who eat only on alternate days, while others eat once in 2 days, 3 days, etc. Some practitioners abstain from food for 4 days, 5 days, 6 days, 7 days, some even for 15 days on end. Some reduce their meal to just one handful of food, while others live on nothing but green vegetables and grass or on cow excrement. All such self-imposed penances constitute self-mortification. These practices were followed by the Nigantha Nataputta sect long before the time of the Buddha. The present-day Jains are the descendants of the Nigantha Nataputta. Their practice of self-mortification was commonly acclaimed and well thought of by the multitude in those days. Hence, when the Bodhisattva gave up austere practices and resumed partaking of normal meals, his intimate colleagues, the group of five monks, forsook him, misjudging that the Bodhisattva had given up the right practice, right exertion, and that he would not attain enlightenment. According to the scriptures of the Nigantha, emancipation from the suffering of samsara is achieved by two means. Number one, means of restraint. This consists in restraining sense objects such as sight, sounds, smells, taste, touch, from entering their body, where it is their belief they will conjoin with the Atman to produce fresh karma. These fresh karmas are believed to form, in turn, new life. And number two, annihilation of results of past karma through torturous penance. Their belief is that results of past misdeeds are expiated and redemption obtained by submitting oneself to self-mortification. The Buddha asked of the naked ascetics who were practicing self-mortification, "You state that you go through physical sufferings to exhaust the results of unwholesome deeds of past existences. But do you know for certain that you have indeed committed unvirtuous acts in previous existences?" Their reply was in the negative. The Buddha further questioned them whether they knew how much unwholesome karma they had done previously, how much of it they had expiated through self-mortification, and how much of it remained. Their replies were all in the negative. They did not know. Then the Buddha explained to them, in order to give them the seed of intellectual advancement, that it was fruitless to practice tortuous penance, not knowing if there were any past misdeeds, nor how much of it they had expiated. The Buddha stated further that these who were trying to absolve themselves from the past misdeeds through self-torture may truly have committed large amounts of unwholesome deeds for which they were now paying through their wrong practice. The Bodhisattva previously adopted extreme measures of practice not with a view to expiate his past misdeeds, if any, but thinking that they would lead to higher knowledge. But after 5 years of strenuous efforts, as stated above, realizing that extreme practices would not lead to knowledge or insight, and wondering whether there was another way that would lead to his cherished goal, he abandoned the practice of self-mortification. Practice of self-torture results only in physical suffering, but it was regarded by naked ascetics as being holy. In order to spare their sensibilities, as explained in the commentary, the Buddha did not denounce the practice as being low or base, nor was it described as vulgar, not being practiced by ordinary village folk, nor as common because ordinary common people did not indulge in it. The Buddha described the method simply as painful and unclean and ignoble, not being followed by the noble persons. Practice of extreme torture also does not pertain to true interests one is seeking after. Not only that it is not concerned with higher ideals of morality, concentration, and wisdom, it does not contribute to anything to mundane advancements. Being a profitless effort resulting only in physical suffering, the austere practices may even prove fatal to the overzealous practitioner. It is utterly profitless. Before the appearance of the supremely enlightened Buddha, it was widely held through India, the middle country, that self-mortification was a noble, holy practice, which truly led to liberation. The group of five monks also held that view. But the Buddha said that extreme practice produced only suffering. They were not indulged in by noble persons, being unclean and ignoble. It did not pertain to the interest one was seeking after. The Buddha therefore clearly advised those who had gone forth from the world to avoid them. A definite pronouncement regarding unworthiness of extreme practice was necessary at that stage, because not only was it universally held that only self-mortification would lead to higher knowledge, the group of five monks also accepted this belief. As long as they held fast to this view, they would not be receptive to the doctrine of the Noble Eightfold Path. Hence, the open denunciation by the Buddha that self-mortification was profitless, leading only to physical suffering. The first extreme portion gives free rein to mind and body, and is therefore to be regarded as too lax or yielding. A free mind not controlled by meditation is liable to sink low in its pursuits of sensual pleasures. It is learned that some teachers are teaching the practice of relaxing the mind, giving it free rein. But the nature of mind is such that it requires constant guard over it. Even when constantly controlled by meditations, the mind wanders forth to objects of sensual pleasure. It is therefore obvious that left by itself, unguarded by meditation, the mind will surely engage itself in thoughts of sensual pleasures. The second extreme practice inflicts suffering on oneself through denial of normal requirements of food and clothing. It is too rigid, unbending, and depriving oneself of an unordinary comfort, it is thus to be avoided too. A wrong interpretation as to what constitutes self-mortification is being made by some teachers in contradiction to the teaching of the Buddha. According to them, earnest, tireless effort required for meditation amounts to self-mortification. This view is diametrically opposed to the exhortation of the Buddha, who advised strenuous, unrelenting exertion, even at the sacrifice of life and limb, to attain concentration and insight. Let only skin, sinew, and bone remain. Let the flesh and blood dry up. I will exert incessantly until I achieve the path and fruition I work for. Such must be the resolute firmness of determination, counseled by the Buddha, with which the goal was to be pursued. Thus, strenuous, relentless effort in meditation practices for achievement of concentration and insight should not be misconstrued as a form of self-torture. Leaving aside meditation practices, even keeping the precepts, which entails some physical discomfort, is not to be regarded as a practice of self-mortification. Young people and young novices suffer from pangs of hunger in the evenings while keeping the eight precepts. But as fasting is done in the fulfillment of the precepts, it does not amount to mortification. For some people, the precept of abstaining from taking life is a sacrifice on their part. They suffer certain disadvantages as a consequence, but as it constitutes the good deed of keeping the precept, it is not to be viewed as a form of self-mortification. In the Mahadhamma Samadhana Sutta of Mulapanasa, the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha explains that such acts of sacrifice at the present time is bound to produce beneficial results in the future. The Buddha said, "In this world, some people abstain from taking life, causing some physical and mental sufferings to themselves. They take up the right view of not killing, for which they have to suffer physically and mentally. These people, thus voluntarily going through this suffering to keep the precepts at the present time, will, after passing away, attain the higher abodes as angels. These 10 meritorious deeds are known as good practices, which produce beneficial results in afterlife through suffering for the present. Thus, any practice which promotes morality, concentration, and wisdom is not profitless, not self-mortification, and that which is not to be indulged in, but beneficial, and is in line with the middle path, which should certainly be followed. It should be definitely noted that only that practice which does not develop morality, concentration, and wisdom, but results merely in physical suffering, constitutes self-mortification. There are some who hold the view that contemplation on pleasant feelings constitutes indulgence in sensual pleasure, while contemplation on painful feelings constitutes self-mortification, the second extreme. Thus they hold on one should avoid both of them and engage only in contemplation of equanimity. This is certainly an irrational misconception not supported by any textual authority. The Buddha had definitely stated in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta that pleasant feelings, painful feelings, as well as equanimity are all objects for contemplation. The same statement was repeated in many other discourses. Thus it should definitely be noted that any object which falls under the category of the five groups of grasping is a legitimate object for meditational contemplation. A lay meditation teacher is reported to have stated, "While engaged in practice of meditation, taking up any posture, if one begins to feel tired, painful, or benumbed, hot or unpleasant in the limbs, one should at once change the posture. If one persists in practice of mindfulness in spite of the unpleasant sensations or tiredness, one is actually engaged in self-torture." This statement is made apparently taking into consideration the welfare of the meditator. Nonetheless, it must be said that it is unsound and ill-advised. In the practice of concentration or insight meditation, patience or self-control plays an important role, is an important factor for the successful practice of concentration or insight meditation. One pointedness of mind can only be achieved through patiently bearing some bodily discomforts. It is within the experience of anyone who has practiced meditation in earnest that continual changing of posture is not conducive to development of concentration. Therefore, unpleasant physical discomfort has to be borne with patience. The self-controlled practice thus is not self-mortification, inasmuch as the goal being not mere suffering, but for the promotion of morality, concentration, and wisdom, in accordance with the wishes of the Buddha. The Blessed One desired, if possible, an even more relentless effort to achieve the noblest fruit of enlightenment by one continuous sitting, uninterrupted by change of posture. In the Mahagosinga Sutta of the Mulapanyasa, the Blessed One stated, "A bhikkhu, a monk, meditates after making a firm resolution. Unclinging, I will remain seated without changing the cross-legged position until the asavas, the defilements, have been removed. Such a monk is an adornment to the Gosinga monastery in the forest of these trees, a valuable asset to the forest abode." Thus, to state that patient contemplation of painful feelings is a form of self-torture is to denounce these meditators who are following the instructions of the Buddha. It also amounts to a rejection of the Buddha's words and discourage the effort of the meditators, who could achieve concentration and insight only through patient bearing of pain brought about by shiftless posture. Okay, and I'm going to stop there. Thanks for coming, everyone. That's the reading for tonight. Now, if there's any discussion, people would like to ask questions or make comments or discuss this, I'm happy to stay on. I think this is sort of a good basis for discussion on meditation practice, talking about the very basics of the Buddha's teaching as to what constitutes right practice and what constitutes wrong practice.